Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link, blacks won't practice group economics, blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up, I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
This video contains descriptions for the visually impaired. Hobbin looking off camera, lights in background.
So many people have low expectations for those of us with disabilities.
Hobbin reading Braille.
They see the disability and think that's the whole story.
Hobbin looking and smiling to camera.
But we're complex. My name is Hobbin Gurma. I'm an advocate for people with disabilities.
Photo, Hobbin wearing a cap and gown receiving her diploma at graduation from Harvard Law.
I graduated from Harvard Law in 2013.
Hobbin at Riverside Country School with an audience of students behind her.
And I use my skills and talents to remove barriers.
Hobbin greeting audience at the podium.
Good morning!
Hobbin and her guide dog standing on steps.
I'm a woman. I'm a person of color. I'm the daughter of refugees. And I'm deafblind.
Text, Harvard Law's first deafblind graduate disrupting disability rights. Hobbin talking to camera.
As a deafblind person in a sighted hearing world, I've struggled to find a system that works well for me to communicate with people.
Text, Hobbin developed her own communication system. Hobbin reading Braille. Text, she uses a wireless keyboard and Braille note computer designed by HumanWare.
I discovered that if I connect a Braille computer with a keyboard, I can easily connect with people.
Reporter laughs while talking to Hobbin.
Most people don't know sign language, but know how to type.
Hobbin reading Braille, person typing.
As people are speaking, I'm reading their words on Braille through my fingers.
Hobbin on keyboard reading Braille.
Over the years, I've heard of other deafblind people also using the system.
Text, Hobbin also travels with her guide dog. Milo sitting beside Hobbin.
With me is a small German shepherd. His name is Milo. He was trained at the Seeing Eye in Morristown, New Jersey. It's like the Harvard of guide dog schools. And now he travels the world with me.
Milo and Haben walking in Paris, France, with L'Arc de Triomphe in front of them.
Sometimes people wonder, why would a blind person travel?
Haben scaling a wall at the City Museum in St. Louis, Missouri.
There's so much to feel and experience and taste.
Haben eating onigiri. Haben partner dancing at a salsa club.
I love partner dancing. I can't hear the beat or see the other dancers, but I can feel the beat through the hands and shoulders of the people I'm dancing with. When I went to Hawaii, I went surfing in the wonderful warm water.
Haben riding a wave in Waikiki, Hawaii.
I reached out to several surf schools, and they told me we've never heard of a deafblind surfer. And then I found one surf school that said, let's find a way, let's figure it out. The instructor surfed side by side. Disability is rarely the problem. The problem is often society creating arbitrary barriers, and we all need to work together to remove those barriers.
Text. Haben is also an aspiring comedian. She attends classes at Face Off Unlimited in Astoria, Queens, in New York City. Haben laughing with the improv group.
I have been thinking about taking improv workshops for a long time. Humor is a powerful tool to help people feel comfortable.
Text. The comedy company created a special class after reading that Haben was turned away in her search for inclusive improv.
Sucks!
Haben interacting with her improv group.
As a person with a disability, I can help a non-disabled person relax.
Haben rehearsing with her improv group.
We're more likely to connect and get past ableism and stereotypes.
Haben's braille typist, Hallie, typing to Haben. Text. Haben also has assistance from her braille typist so she knows what each person is saying. Arrow pointing to Hallie. Haben's improv partner speaks.
I know there's a very large contract you have to sign. I didn't read it.
Haben talking to her improv partner.
I'm still thinking about the fact that you didn't read the contract.
Crowd laughs. Text. Haben finished Harvard Law in 2013. She is the first and only deafblind graduate from Harvard Law. Photo of Haben with her parents on graduation day at Harvard.
My parents had high expectations for me, and that taught me to also have high expectations for myself. I decided to become an attorney when I was in college.
Haben walking with Hallie and Riverside Country School staff into auditorium.
I noticed that when I used the Americans with Disabilities Act to remove barriers, it changed the whole culture, and I wanted to continue doing that.
Auditorium filling with students and bleachers.
I can't let fear control my life. I'm going to instead focus on what I can do.
Haben talking to audience.
Sign language is a form of innovation. I was told that if I wanted to get a job as an attorney, I needed to go to the best school possible. So I applied to Harvard, even though I thought I probably wouldn't get in. It was worth a shot just to try.
Students in auditorium clapping.
I learned that I got in, and I was thrilled.
Haben showing her keyboard to the auditorium.
Now I travel around the world teaching organizations to invest in accessibility.
Haben shakes a student's hand. Text. Haben is an advocate for accessibility and technological advances.
The majority of apps are not accessible.
Haben typing on her keyboard.
We keep asking engineers, developers, design with access in mind.
Haben texting her friend Gordon.
Reply. Button.
Because it drives innovation, drives revenue, and benefits all of us in the long run.
Text, quote, don't call me inspirational, end quote. Haben skiing with guide.
People with disabilities get called inspirational all the time.
President Obama giving Haben a hug in the White House.
My response is, what are you inspired to do? Allow that emotion to drive change. Disability is not the biggest barrier. The biggest barrier is people telling me you can't do something.
Haben speaking at the president's address.
Ask people and hold them accountable. Allow me to share a story.
Panoramic portrait shot of Haben.
All my success shows what is possible when we create inclusive communities and give kids with disabilities an opportunity from the start. Inclusion is a choice.
CNBC Make It End credits.
Racism, sexism, homophobia. When
say these words, a lot can happen at once. A flashback to an experience with one of them, or your city's most recent equality parade. But when I say ableism, oftentimes many people don't know what that is, and this is a huge problem. Ableism is the discrimination of people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, IDD. Someone with IDD can be in a wheelchair, have autism, Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, vision or hearing loss, and so much more. We as a society minimize ableism as lesser of a problem. That's why you've probably never heard of it. We look at African Americans, women, and homosexuals and think they are no lesser of people, and they deserve equal rights, pay, and respect. Any violation of that is discrimination, and it won't be tolerated. Not all of this is true, 100%. But when it comes to someone with a disability, without even giving a second thought to it, we simultaneously think that because they can't perform a certain action or do a certain job, that these basic and fundamental rules of equality do not apply to them, when in reality, they should. We see non-intentional ableism all around us, every day. Pushing someone in a wheelchair without their permission because you think that you're helping them. A building not having accessible facilities. Saying the R word, retard, or retarded, even in a joke. These are all examples of non-intentional ableism. However, there is a more severe type of ableism known as intentional ableism. And truth be told, as upsetting and degrading as intentional ableism can be, it often starts in the most minuscule place as the average middle school. We catch middle school students using the words mental, autistic, the R word, and many other degrading terms, even in jokes. And for every child using that vocabulary, there's a disabled kid hurt. The problem is, many parents, teachers, and students think that because there is no physical violence going on, or the words were said in a joking manner, that the problem isn't that real, when in reality, it hurts just as much as physical violence. From my experience, middle school is a developing stage in which students begin to become ableist. I have been a part of Best Buddies, a nonprofit international organization focused on ending ableism, for almost 2 years now. When the organization came to my middle school, not many people joined, but thankfully I did. In a short time of being there, it completely transformed me. I was making new friends, having a more optimistic view on life, and I could see that our students with disabilities were benefiting too. They would walk the halls proud and confident of who they were because they knew that a strong and supportive group of people had their back. Once a month Wednesday meetings seemed to make me and others better people. This organization taught me a lot about equality and an issue that I had no idea existed, but I later found out that it had existed for a very long time. From the days of the Soviet Union to the times of the Holocaust, ableism has seemed to make its way around the world. But now more than ever, it's not just a problem, it's an epidemic, with ableism getting to young students across the globe. Yes, some students are ignorant. They use upsetting ableist vocabulary. But the problem is, the approach that we often take, just telling them to stop or cut it out, often makes matters worse. So last year in Best Buddies, in my chapter, when we were having our third or fourth meeting, we were focusing in on how much students use degrading ableist vocabulary, but we were focusing in on one word, the R word. And so we decided to take place in the annual Spread the Word to End the Word Day to raise awareness about ending the use of the R word. We spread a message of kindness all day, but there was just one problem. Many students said the R word all day. But you might ask why. Why would a seemingly great plan for an amazing cause fail, especially with students at such a young age? Well, that has to do with the middle school mind. You see, when an organization like Best Buddies comes to a middle school, students often think, who are they to tell me what to do? I'll say whatever I want, whenever I want. And so unfortunately, the plan backfires. It's like the students being rebellious, cool, trying to show off to their friends. Either way, they were saying the R word all day, and our plan often backfired. I could see that from then, that day was a turning point. Our supporters on day one are still supporting us today, some even joining Best Buddies, but the students that were using degrading language to be cool or show off are still using that today. The problem is, when simply saying the R word didn't get enough, they would target members of Best Buddies themselves. They would say the R word in front of us, just to get on our nerves, because they knew, and we knew, that it was a trap. If we spoke up about what we knew was right and what we believed was right, we would be humiliated in front of our friends and peers. But if we stayed silent, we were letting them win, and we were letting the message get out that it was okay to discriminate against disabled people, which is not what we want to do. It seemed like a lost cause. Eventually, once members realized this, they lost hope. And unfortunately, eventually, I lost mine. We would lie low when we heard teasing, bullying, or any other, because we didn't want to be humiliated. We wanted so hard to keep things professional, but at the same time, it was getting personal. And we attend this middle school. We need social status to survive. But at some point, it wasn't just lying low. I was watching as the world was cruel and degrading to our students with disabilities. They would get mean and nasty looks in the hallways, and they would be made fun of for speaking up in class, but I felt that there was nothing I could do. Every day and every night, it was a constant struggle with myself. I would ask myself, what do I believe in? What am I going to stand up for? My popularity or what I believe is right? Am I going to make a difference or am I going to stay silent? I wasn't supporting not using the R word, but I wasn't not supporting it either. I just was. I existed at this middle school with no purpose, no cause, and I felt really bad that I wasn't sticking up for others. But at some point I broke. I just changed. Something changed. Little did I know that it would be right in the middle of math class. I know. We were going over a homework in a group around 4 or 5, and in that group there were 2 best friends, always making jokes, always laughing. One of them gets something wrong, and the other one says, as a joke, "Oh my gosh, you're so autistic." I didn't know it at the time, but every time I was lying low, staying silent, it was eating away little by little at my morals. But I just knew in that moment, deep down, I couldn't afford to lose anymore. I had to speak up. I had to say something, but I couldn't risk being humiliated. Not again. I had no idea what to do. I broke out into a cold sweat. I was short-breathed, my heart was racing, and I made a quick, instinctual decision. And I overcame what was possibly the longest moment of my entire life, but I took a deep breath, and all I could say was, "Stop. You're not funny. You're making a stereotype, and you're saying that autistic people are stupid and can't learn. It's wrong, it's degrading, and you have to cut it out." To which he replied, "Calm down. It was just a joke." See, that was my limit. That was when I knew what I had to stand up for. And it wasn't my popularity. It wasn't my social status. It was what I knew was right to end ableism. I said, "You know what's not funny? That 60% of people with disabilities will have been bullied. That 84% will be unemployed. That 83% will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. And they are 2 times more likely to live in poverty and 19% less likely to graduate. I don't find that very funny. I don't find that a joke." Of course he laughed. He made fun of this cause. And unfortunately, like many others, he's still using degrading language to this day. But the best part about those moments was that I was not angry or annoyed or frustrated. I was rejuvenated because I realized what I had to stand up for. I realized in those moments that we can't just wait and watch life fix itself. We have to change society and we have to end ableism. In order to fight this human rights fight, we have to fight it together. The only way that we can end ableism in our modern day world is by making a change. And the only way that we can make a change is with an open mind, an open heart, and an open door to inclusion. Thank you very much.
Harriet Tubman began her life in the bonds of slavery, but lived her life helping others achieve their freedom.
She really helped black people have a sense of self, a sense of freedom, and a sense that, you know, slavery was not right.
Hey,
Araminta Harriet Ross was born into slavery around 1820 in Dorchester County, Maryland. As a child, she was loaned out to different plantations. By the time she turned 12, she was working in the fields. When she was a young teen, she suffered a severe injury which would affect her for the rest of her life.
A slave owner threw a metal weight at another slave and accidentally hit her in the head. For the rest of her life, she suffered epilepsy, terrible headaches, but she also had these strange visions, which she ascribed to God communicating to her. And she took these visions as a symbol of her mission, like Moses, to go and free her people.
In 1844, she married John Tubman, who was a free black man, a fairly common occurrence in Maryland. Harriet was determined to escape her life of slavery, and in 1849, she finally did it. She risked her life by making her way from Maryland to Philadelphia. She followed the North Star and used the so-called Underground Railroad to make it to freedom.
Lord, I'm a pilgrim.
The Underground Railroad was an organized group of free blacks, whites, and Christian abolitionists who helped slaves escape to the North. Harriet had made it to the Promised Land. No one would have blamed her if she never returned to the South, but she desperately wanted to free her family. She made perilous trips back to free her two brothers, her sister, and her sister's two children. When she made a third trip to get her husband, she found he had taken another wife. Instead of returning with her husband, she saved more slaves.
Not only did she escape slavery and achieve freedom for herself, but she went back down into the South to bring freedom to dozens of other slaves.
Harriet was clever as she was brave, figuring out countless tricks to bring many slaves to freedom over the next several years.
The fact that she developed these paths and trails that took people through the country, and they traveled at night and they used quilts to have secret codes and know the paths, and then to bring people north across the Mason-Dixon line into Ohio to find freedom. So she was a pioneer and I think a very, very strong woman.
Her legendary status as an Underground Railroad conductor earned her the nickname Moses.
Well, I think Harriet Tubman's name, Moses, you know, comes from Moses from the Bible, leading people to freedom. And it's a very, very proper name, I think, for her, and one that she definitely lived up to.
In 1850, things became more dangerous for Harriet when the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. Instead of being a free woman, she was now a fugitive. She continued to free slaves, but now guiding them to Canada so they could truly be free. From 1851 to 1857, Harriet lived mostly north of the border in St. Catharines, Canada. She continued to make trips to Maryland twice a year to save more slaves. Besides her work as a liberator of slaves, Harriet spoke in support of anti-slavery and women's rights. Her efforts made her a wanted woman with a bounty on her head, but she was never turned in. She aided abolitionist John Brown with his plans for the raid on Harper's Ferry. During the Civil War, the government asked her to help the Union cause by organizing a network of spies among black men in the South.
Not only was she known as the Great Liberator, but she also assisted the Union Army, going down on patrols and advising Union officers on how best to attack the South.
Out in the trenches, she also helped Colonel James Montgomery disrupt Southern supply lines, which resulted in the freedom of hundreds of slaves. After the war, Harriet dedicated herself to establishing schools for freed men in South Carolina. Even though she couldn't read or write, she understood the value of education. In her later years, Tubman worked with her friend, Susan B. Anthony, to support the cause of women's suffrage.
Harriet Tubman is relevant today, not only for her work in terms of racial justice, but also in terms of women's rights. After the Civil War, she became an outspoken supporter for the suffrage movement to get women the right to vote.
To help make ends meet and continue to help the causes she believed in, she worked on a book called Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman. In 1908, she established a home for older poor African Americans in Auburn, New York, which she moved into in 1911. She lived there till her death in 1913 from pneumonia. She was buried with full military honors.
I was young, but I remember.
Harriet Tubman, has a lot of significance for black people, particularly in the age of Obama, because she kind of started the liberation of black people, in the days of slavery, and really set the path of civil rights in the United States.
Harriet Tubman's bravery and determination allowed her to accomplish incredible things throughout her amazing life.
From Galilee.
She is someone that you cannot forget. She is someone that really kind of changed our perception of what equality and freedom and liberation and civil rights mean.
The hour I first believed.
Born into slavery on Maryland's eastern shore, Harriet Tubman escaped to freedom in 1849. It was just the first of her many dangerous forays leading runaway slaves from safe house to safe house.
Harriet Tubman was a very spiritual, very religious person, and carried this hymnal with her on her trips to bring people out of the Eastern Shore in Maryland. She would often sing with them and pray with them. And
now, is this her favorite song?
Many of the pages have little X's that designate those hymns as her favorites.
Oh, okay. Wow.
The shawl, evidently this was a very favorite piece of hers.
It was tiny.
Very tiny. But she was very strong, very determined, very directed, and had a kind of forcefulness and a kind of authority that people felt when they were with her. You know, they followed her orders and did what she said.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't, she famously threatened to shoot them because she couldn't risk alerting the enemy to their presence.
Wow. Just no. Took charge. Oh, what an amazing woman.
I think the common vision that people have of Harriet Tubman is this woman who would go south during the Underground Railroad and would bring people north. And that's all she was about, and that was her claim to fame.
By secret paths and waterways, Tubman did lead dozens of slaves to freedom. But her experience also made her a valuable military asset.
The skills she gained as a young woman in terms of the ability to, go in the woods and travel in strange places translates into very useful skills for the Union Army.
In 1863, the Union command sent her deep behind enemy lines in South Carolina to lay the groundwork for a daring plantation raid.
She goes inland into South Carolina and establishes relationships with local people.
On the night of June 2nd, she planned a covert operation on the Combahee River. As dawn broke, they took three plantations by surprise. Tubman gave a signal, and the enslaved people rushed to freedom. They burned storehouses and destroyed crops, crippling supply lines. One Confederate captain fumed, their success was complete.
Harriet Tubman began her life in the bonds of slavery, but lived her life helping others achieve their freedom.
She really helped Black people have a sense of self, a sense of freedom, and a sense that, you know, slavery was not right.
Araminta Harriet Ross was born into slavery around 1820 in Dorchester County, Maryland. As a child, she was loaned out to different plantations. By the time she turned 12, she was working in the fields. When she was a young teen, she suffered a severe injury which would affect her for the rest of her life.
A slave owner threw a metal weight at another slave and accidentally hit her in the head. For the rest of her life, she suffered epilepsy, terrible headaches, but she also had these strange visions, which she ascribed to God communicating to her. And she took these visions as a symbol of her mission, like Moses, to go and free her people.
In 1844, she married John Tubman, who was a free Black man, a fairly common occurrence in Maryland. Harriet was determined to escape her life of slavery, and in 1849, she finally did it. She risked her life by making her way from Maryland to Philadelphia. She followed the North Star and used the so-called Underground Railroad to make it to freedom.
Lord, I'm a pilgrim.
The Underground Railroad was an organized group of free Blacks, whites, and Christian abolitionists who helped slaves escape to the North. Harriet had made it to the Promised Land. No one would have blamed her if she never returned to the South, but she desperately wanted to free her family. She made perilous trips back to free her two brothers, her sister, and her sister's two children. When she made a third trip to get her husband, she found he had taken another wife. Instead of returning with her husband, she saved more slaves.
Not only did she escape slavery and achieve freedom for herself, but she went back down into the South to bring freedom to dozens of other slaves.
Harriet was clever as she was brave, figuring out countless tricks to bring many slaves to freedom over the next several years.
The fact that she developed these paths and trails that took people through the country, and they traveled at night and they used quilts to have secret codes and know the paths, and then to bring people north across the Mason-Dixon line into Ohio to find freedom. So she was a pioneer and I think a very, very strong woman.
Her legendary status as an Underground Railroad conductor earned her the nickname Moses.
Well, I think Harriet Tubman's name Moses, you know, comes from Moses from the Bible, leading people to freedom. And it's a very, very proper name, I think, for her, and one that she definitely lived up to.
In 1850, things became more dangerous for Harriet when the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. Instead of being a free woman, she was now a fugitive. She continued to free slaves, but now guiding them to Canada so they could truly be free. From 1851 to 1857, Harriet lived mostly north of the border in St. Catharines, Canada. She continued to make trips to Maryland twice a year to save more slaves. Besides her work as a liberator of slaves, Harriet spoke in support of anti-slavery and women's rights. Her efforts made her a wanted woman with a bounty on her head, but she was never turned in. She aided abolitionist John Brown with his plans for the raid on Harper's Ferry. During the Civil War, the government asked her to help the Union cause by organizing a network of spies among Black men in the South.
Not only was she known as the Great Liberator, but she also assisted the Union Army, going down on patrols and advising Union officers on how best to attack the South.
Out in the trenches, she also helped Colonel James Montgomery disrupt Southern supply lines, which resulted in the freedom of hundreds of slaves. After the war, Harriet dedicated herself to establishing schools for freedmen in South Carolina. Even though she couldn't read or write, she understood the value of education. In her later years, Tubman worked with her friend, Susan B. Anthony, to support the cause of women's suffrage.
Harriet Tubman is relevant today, not only for her work in terms of racial justice, but also in terms of women's rights. After the Civil War, she became an outspoken supporter for the suffrage movement to get women the right to vote.
To help make ends meet and continue to help the causes she believed in, she worked on a book called Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman. In 1908, she established a home for older poor African Americans in Auburn, New York, which she moved into in 1911. She lived there till her death in 1913 from pneumonia. She was buried with full military honors.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to begin by running you through a brief exercise. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of the word ableism. Okay, that's not bad. Now raise your hand if you've ever used the word ableist to describe a problem that you perceived as unequal. Okay, a lot fewer. Now if you didn't raise your hand to one or both of those, you're not alone. Very few people actively frame the problems that they face as ableist. The word just hasn't really entered our vocabulary like other terms for different forms of oppression have. In fact, when I was dictating this very presentation onto a Google Doc, Google kept trying to autocorrect the word ableist. It hadn't even been entered into whatever dictionary Google was referencing. But what is ableism? Ableism is a form of discrimination in favor of able-bodied people and a discrimination against people with disabilities. Ableism creates a hostile environment for people whose bodies just don't fit the able-bodied norm. And in my opinion, ableism remains one of the last broad, socially acceptable forms of discrimination. Now, at this point, you're probably wondering, why is this perfectly healthy-looking person standing in front of you talking about ableism? And honestly, I think that's a pretty fair point. But it's also an assumption. I have an invisible disability, and learning to live with an invisible disability is part of the story that I want to share with you today. I became disabled when I was 16 with a really mysterious neuromuscular pain syndrome. And it was then and remains to this day a medical mystery. But I have one particular type of disability which comes with its own set of problems and experiences. And when I talk about ableism today, broadly construed, I might be talking about things and experiences that will differ drastically from my own. Disability is complicated. There's no one way to be disabled. And I'm not going to stand up here today and talk to you about how my disability is easier or harder to live with than someone else's, because to me that entirely misses the point. And the point is that there remains work to be done when it comes to combating ableism. Ableism is insidious. It's coded everywhere into our society, even into our language. We use the word upstanding, for example, to refer to someone who we think is great, without even stopping to think about what that says about how we view people who can't walk. In the media, disability often takes the form of three major stock characters. There's the disabled villain, the disabled victim, and the disabled superhero who somehow seems to overcome the very definitional limits of their disability. And although there are positives and negatives associated with those stereotypes, I really want to dwell upon the disabled villain. Every Halloween, people dress up as monsters and ghouls and evil spirits, and they dress up as the disabled. Now, It's not just that we're coding disability to be something that's sad or pathetic. The disabled villain is the explicit manifestation of our societal fear of and disdain for disabled people. And now, unfortunately, this doesn't just happen in movies. Throughout history, disability and ableism has been used as an axis of oppression that often transgresses many of our common conceptions of the boundaries around different oppressed peoples. During the Second World War, anyone who was labeled as unproductive to the cause and the creation of the Aryan nation was labeled for extermination. Jews were referred to as parasites that sapped the resources of the state. The LGBTQ community was referred to as unproductive because of their literal inability to reproduce. And over 200,000 people who were labeled as handicapped were either imprisoned or murdered because of their inability to be productive members of society. Another example of ableism being used as an axis of oppression comes to us from the historical conception of what it means to be a woman. Freud often referred to women as defective men. And throughout history, women have been oppressed based on what they were perceived to be capable of or not. I think female hysteria, the medicalization of a perfectly healthy, normal, sexually active female woman, is a really wonderful example of this really horrendous problem. And now each of these cases tells us something oppressive and pretty awful about each of these categories of people. But what often gets lost in the midst of that is the fact that each of these cases also say something oppressive and awful about anyone whose body is different from those that are deemed to be normal, or anyone who's deemed to be less productive than the rest of society. But rarely do we actively stop to think about what productivity actually means. Virginia Woolf referred to this narrow obsession that we have with productivity to no real clear end goal as the army of the upright. And today, I think it's really important that we face that army head on. But see, there are a lot of ways that we could go about trying to combat ableism. It's just a really huge problem. We could go about it by talking about law and policy, and we can address representation in the media. But I think that fundamentally, combating ableism begins right here. It begins with reconceptualizing what it means for someone to be disabled. It means believing that there's actually something worth fighting for. Elizabeth Barnes, a professor of philosophy at the University of Virginia, did exactly that. Barnes's reconception of what it means for someone to be disabled is called the mere difference view. And although I'm going to be oversimplifying it a little bit, its main idea is that the problem that people with disabilities face are often rooted in the way that society is structured, and it's not innate to their physical beings. Being disabled is just a merely different way of having a body. Now, I think in order to really understand and grasp the mere difference view, it's really useful to imagine a thought experiment. So consider someone who's a member of the deaf community. In our dominantly hearing society, we often think of this person as disabled because they are incapable of doing many things that we believe that normal people can do. But when we view this person in the context with the rest of the deaf community, it's really not so clear that they're actually disabled. In fact, many members of the deaf community don't think of themselves as disabled. And when someone who's not a member of the deaf community enters, they often find themselves feeling as if they take on the role that we associate being disabled to have. They might find themselves feeling out of touch with deaf culture or isolated from their peers or less able to contribute than their ostensibly disabled counterparts. But now let's take this idea farther and imagine that almost everyone in this society is a member of the deaf community. Our teachers are deaf and make lesson plans that reflect that fact. Our politicians are deaf and they write laws and policies that reflect the habits and interests of the deaf community. But you are not deaf. You are subject to awful and distracting noises, which decrease your productivity, which decrease your ability to sleep. You feel isolated from the rest of the world around you. You feel really different and perhaps even alone. And everyone looks down on you with pity because you were born with the disabling effects of having been born with hearing. Now, this is what it means for disability to be socially constructed. It's not that there aren't real physical limitations that people face. It's just that the way society is structured has made having some of those physical differences a lot harder than having others. In other words, there's nothing innately better or worse about having hearing or not, any more than there's something innately better or worse about being a woman. It's just that the way society has been structured has made it a lot harder to be a woman throughout history. Now, if maybe at this point you haven't totally bought into the mere difference view, I understand that. It's kind of a hard thing to wrap your head around or really buy into. But I hope that you're willing to take the leap of faith in imagining what a world with the mere difference view in it could look like. And to get you into that mindset, I want to share with you how the mere difference view has changed the way that I view my disability. 4 years ago, That medical mystery entered my life. My arms began to shut down. I was in a lot of pain, and I was 16. I had just qualified for my first national championships in swimming, and like most 16-year-olds, I was really, really excited about the fact that I was finally kind of finding my stride and getting into the things that I really, truly loved. Back then, I really considered myself three things, a swimmer, a pianist, and a cellist. And today I stand before you as none of those things. When I first realized that my disability was here to stay, I simultaneously knew that I would be okay and I felt like my world was ending. It was as if in the blink of an eye, everything I had dedicated the last decade of my life to, I just suddenly disappeared. And I was just left in this vacuum of inadequacy. Now, this was back in the summer before my junior year. And I remember thinking then that because I couldn't write or type for any period of time, that I was genuinely afraid to go back to school. And honestly, those fears were not unfounded. Relearning how to go back to school was one of the hardest things that I've ever done. I really struggled with feeling isolated, like nobody would believe me because I didn't have a label to put on my disability. And I was really frustrated by the fact that I was just getting slower and slower and slower at things that used to take me just minutes and that were mindless. And I think more than anything, I really struggled with just coping with the fact that I had lost basically everything I had dedicated my life to. But gradually, you know, things kind of began to improve. I learned to start focusing on what I could do rather than what I couldn't. And I had a lot of people there to support me and help me along the way. And that attitude just kind of kept growing and growing and growing until eventually I found myself here at this institution. But I'm not going to stand here and pretend like I'm effortlessly living with this disability because I think that that's honestly kind of just unfair to myself and the experience. You know, what they don't tell you when you get into this school for having overcome things is that when you get here, you have to keep overcoming those same things. And that can be really frustrating. It can be really, really hard to just stand and watch your peers do things that they often just take for granted, that I know I will spend hours literally agonizing over. But I'm proud to be able to stand before you today and share the fact that I have learned how to refocus my life. I actually started coaching swimming as a means to get back into the sport that I loved so much. And just this past year, I joined the Yale Glee Club, which has been an amazing way to get back into music after so, so many years. And now I'm telling you all this not because I want you to feel pity or because I want you to feel inspired by what I'm saying, but what I want you to realize is that for me, the mere difference view isn't simply theoretical. The mere difference view is the difference between standing in front of the mirror and seeing someone who is innately less than their 16-year-old self, and seeing someone who just has a different body with a different life experience. The mere difference view is the difference between feeling the need to constantly fight to overcome my disability, like those headlines said, and learning to live with, accept, and even be proud of the fact that I am disabled. The mere difference view isn't just about being nicer to disabled people, although I think that's a great place to start. It's a whole lot bigger than that. The mere difference view is to see value where other people see none. The mere difference view is to choose to usurp that history of ableism. The mere difference view is to choose to believe that we are all truly equal in our differences. Every one of us has the power to tap into that equality. And it can be as simple as just changing our frame of mind, changing the way that we look at the people around us. And now at this point, you might be wondering, how do we use it? How do we tap into that? And to that, honestly, I think we all already know. This is a picture of Stephen Hawking. And I would feel pretty uncomfortable if I were to stand up here and say, you know what, Stephen Hawking was a burden to our society because he couldn't walk. We look at Stephen Hawking and we see someone who was brilliant. We value Stephen Hawking as someone who was merely different. But just because Stephen Hawking was exceptionally brilliant doesn't mean that he has to be the exception to the norm. I stand before you today because of people who believed in the power to view other people as merely different. My English professor, Shifra Sharlin, when I got here this past year, looked at me with genuine excitement when I told her that I had to dictate my work, because she said that she was thrilled by the idea of someone engaging in an entirely new form of art. That's the kind of power that each and every one of us wields. And if you remember anything from this talk today, I want it to be this. When you encounter someone who is maybe physically or mentally different from you, or perhaps you find yourself in a position where you are physically or mentally different than you once were, I want you to remember that you have a choice. You can choose to look at things through the historical lens of ableism and just see a mountain of shortcomings. Or you can choose to see value. You can choose to see people as innately less, or you can choose to see people as innately equal. But why choose less than when you can choose equal? Truly. We all have the power to make that choice. And imagine how much better of a world we would live in if we all went out and actually used that power. Which begs the question, why haven't we? At the beginning of this talk, I asked you how familiar you were with ableism. And the responses were definitely less than unanimous. But see, to tap into the power of the mere difference view, we have to start using the word ableism first. We have to believe that there is actually a problem before we can go out and fix it. We have to talk about it. So talk about it. Start a conversation about ableism, because only then can we all truly engage with the power that each and every one of us has to make this world merely different. Thank you.
Today's podcast is titled Harriet Tubman, A Wealthy Woman. Harriet Tubman, as we all know, started out life as a slave. And she couldn't read or write. She was very, very literate. She was a nurse, spy, had a few other jobs. So she had a, she had ways to generate an income when needed. She purchased, and here the operative words here, purchased. She purchased, at least in my findings so far, about in two transactions, 25 acres of land. I think the first transaction, which in today's dollars will range from $24,000 up to maybe $34,000, but she had it in the equivalent of that day. Just putting it in 2020 dollars. Just she was not a poor, destitute woman. She, her first transaction, she purchased for 5 acres. And then in her second purchase, by way of an auction, but she still had to come out of her pocket, she purchased 25 acres. Part of the way she supported her elderly parents, that cost money. She had plenty of social capital. Not today, but we're going to look at the Underground Railroad, because traveling, even with the Underground Railroad, you did have to have some financial literacy, some financial wit, and some financial resources to travel at. So the Underground Railroad wasn't for broke, destitute people. I'm not saying you have to be rich or a millionaire, but the picture that they paint, in my opinion, doesn't give a full thing. But Harriet Tubman was a wealthy woman. Now, one of the reasons why I played some of these audios today that talked about ableism is because many of the times when we're on our tycoon reparations, excuse me, on my our reparations tycoon series, we featured Isaiah Montgomery yesterday. Now, today, our feature spotlight is on Harriet Tubman being a reparations tycoon. Because, number one, she ran away from her master. But she bought that 5 acres from a white person. Like, say, she paid for 5 acres. And if we put things into a 2020 inflationary mode, most people don't own 5 acres of land, number one. And number two, she paid for it with an equivalent of at least $24,000 in today's money. Now, a lot of people don't have $24,000. A lot of people do, but a lot of people don't. So she was not a broke, destitute woman. Now, typically, when we're reading about when we read about a Benjamin Montgomery, or any time we start off something with a person that was a slave or born a slave or whatever, we're reading it with as if these people were handicapped. That's where ableism comes in at. Matter of fact, let me read some definitions to you. The difference between disability and handicap. A handicap is a way, and we're going to tie this into why I say that blacks in 2020, do you really deserve reparations? Okay. Now, a handicap is a way the impairment, all right, a handicap is the way impairment restricts or limits a person's normal functioning. Disability describes the person's limitation, while handicap refers to the impact the person's disability has on normal life activities, such as going to school, driving a car, etc. All right. When it comes to ableism, all right, there's physical ableism. Physical ableism is the first and most likely best-known form of ableism that is induced by a physical inability. Mental ableism, a mental disability, might be less known, a less known cause of disability, as it may not and always be displayed on our bodies. And then there's cultural ableism. Now, one of the audios that I played was, what's the lady's name? It's a black lady that, Habeen Grima, or Grima. Yeah, no, no, Habeen Grima. She's a woman of immigrant parents. She herself is blind, and she's also deaf. Also identified by the culture at large as black female. Now, Habeen's parents did not treat their daughter. Oh, I forgot the most important part. Habeen Grima on YouTube is a Harvard Law School graduate. All right. Now, Harvard's had plenty of black females graduate law school, no big deal. But once again, she's blind and she's deaf. And since we're, you know, most of the people that listen to this podcast are United States citizens, although we got them in Russia too, black. And once again, throwing the immigrant parents. Her parents did not treat her, they did not look at her blindness or the fact that she cannot hear, she's deaf. They did not treat them, those two facts, as a handicap. They didn't treat it as a disability. So growing up in that mindset, she grew up in a mindset where okay, I'm blind, but that's not a disability. It's not a handicap. Or, okay, I can't hear, but it's not a handicap or a disability. And with that attitude, she got through school like everybody else, grades 1 through 12, undergraduate school, and then, of course, applied to Harvard Law School and got through that. Now, law school's a boot camp. So, now, ableism, at least the way I'm looking at it, she didn't buy into ableism. In other words, okay, just because I'm deaf and just because I can't see, able to do what anybody else is able to do. She didn't buy into that. That's why I don't play into white supremacy. In my opinion, there are too many on a critical mass basis, not all, but on a critical mass basis, what the percentage is, I don't know. But in my opinion, there are too many African Americans that play into the self-imposed handicap of white supremacy. They treat it as a handicap, and it's self-imposed. so what? They have laws on the books during the Jim Crow era. That's why I have this series that I've done for the over the last 6 years. I do it about three or four times a year. Jim Crow millionaires. Madam C.J. Walker did not allow her sex, her color, or her race. She did not see those as a handicap. She got fabulously wealthy. And there are many others like her. With this Reparations Tycoon series, which is sort of like the Millionaire, Jim Crow Millionaire series, Ben Montgomery, who was born a slave, but later on freed and bought the plantation that he was a part of, 5,000 acres, he did not see the fact that he was born a slave as a handicap. He didn't see it as a disability. If anything, he saw the so-called disadvantage of slavery as his advantage, and that allowed him to purchase the plantation. His son, Isaiah Montgomery, he didn't play into ableism either. He did not see himself disabled. He did not see himself as disenfranchised. He did not see himself handicapped by the color of his skin, nor would he allow anybody else to treat him that way. Thus, he did something which is considered outrageous, particularly back when he did it. He founded Mount Bayou, Mississippi, which still exists to this day. Harriet Tubman, the same thing. She did not allow the fact that she was born a slave to stop her from what she needed to do. She did not, they were lynching back when she was alive now. She did not stop, she didn't, on her missions, she didn't let that stop her. Those missions cost money. She had to earn money when she needed to. She didn't, no excuses. Play the Habeen Grima audio again before I go to the phone lines, because once again, here is a woman of color, immigrant parents, blind, deaf. That's one of the reasons why I play, you know, the Jamarion, and I've contacted Jamarion through online. I'm just waiting for him to get back to me so we can have him on this podcast. The kid with no arms who went out for the basketball team and made it. And then when he got in the game, he scored twice. He didn't play into the ableism narrative. He saw himself able-bodied, although he didn't have arms, to be on the basketball team and play and do anything else that a basketball player would do in a basketball game. Harriet Tubman, same thing. So now, in reference to Harriet Tubman being our reparations tycoon for the day, because the word tycoon means great leader, Harriet Tubman, once again, Her first real estate transaction, she purchased 5 acres of land with an equivalent of about at least $24,000 in cash. And if you translate it in today's dollars. Her next 25 acres, which would give her a total of 30 acres, purchased at an auction. Cash sale again. This was not a poor woman. And if we put it in terms of some of the entrepreneurial opportunities that have existed from then until now, she also made money by renting out rooms, which is what essentially that's what Airbnb does through the app. So she had a passive income by renting out rooms. Couldn't read. Couldn't write. Well, no, I'm going to say couldn't because that plays an ableism. Didn't read, didn't write, but she sure was literate and financially literate. If Harriet Tubman wasn't whining about reparations, why should you in 2020? Anyway, let me play this Heaven Grimmer, the woman of color who can't see, who's deaf, and is a Harvard Law School grad, now a lawyer. And she's not asking for reparations.
This video contains descriptions for the visually impaired. Hobbin looking off camera, lights in background.
So many people have low expectations for those of us with disabilities.
Hobbin reading Braille.
They see the disability and think that's the whole story.
Hobbin looking and smiling to camera.
But we're complex. My name is Hobbin Grima. I'm an advocate for people with disabilities.
Photo, Hobbin wearing a cap and gown receiving her diploma at graduation from Harvard Law.
I graduated from Harvard Law in 2013.
Hobbin at Riverside Country School with an audience of students behind her.
And I use my skills and talents to remove barriers.
Hobbin greeting audience at the podium.
Good morning!
Hobbin and her guide dog standing on steps.
I'm a woman. I'm a person of color. I'm the daughter of refugees. And I'm deafblind.
Text, Harvard Law's first deafblind graduate disrupting disability rights. Hobbin talking to camera.
As a deafblind person in a sighted hearing world, I've struggled to find a system that works well for me to communicate with people.
Text, Hobbin developed her own communication system. Hobbin reading Braille. Text, she uses a wireless keyboard and Braille note computer designed by HumanWare.
I discovered that if I connect a Braille computer with a keyboard, I can easily connect with people.
Reporter laughs while talking to Hobbin.
Most people don't know sign language, but know how to type.
Hobbin reading Braille. Person typing.
As people are speaking, I'm reading their words on Braille through my fingers.
Hobbin on keyboard reading Braille.
Over the years, I've heard of other deafblind people also using the system.
Text. Hobbin also travels with her guide dog. Milo sitting beside Hobbin.
With me is a small German shepherd. His name is Milo. He was trained at the Seeing Eye in Morristown, New Jersey. It's like the Harvard of guide dog schools. And now he travels the world with me.
Milo and Hobbin walking in Paris, France with L'Arc de Triomphe in front of them.
Sometimes people wonder, why would a blind person travel?
Hobbin scaling a wall at the City Museum in St. Louis, Missouri.
There's so much to feel and experience and taste.
Hobbin eating onigiri. Hobbin partner dancing at a salsa club.
I love partner dancing. I can't hear the beat or see the other dancers, but I can feel the beat through the hands and shoulders of the people I'm dancing with. When I went to Hawaii, I went surfing in the wonderful warm water.
Hobbin riding a wave in Waikiki, Hawaii.
I reached out to several surf schools, and they told me we've never heard of a deafblind surfer. And then I found one surf school that said, let's find a way, let's figure it out. The instructor surfed side by side. Disability is rarely the problem. The problem is often society creating arbitrary barriers and we all need to work together to remove those barriers.
Text. Hobbin is also an aspiring comedian. She attends classes at Face Off Unlimited in Astoria, Queens, in New York City. Hobbin laughing with the improv group.
I've been thinking about taking improv workshops for a long time. Humor is a powerful tool to help people feel comfortable.
Text. The comedy company created a special class after reading that Hobbin was turned away in her search for inclusive improv.
Socks!
Hobbin interacting with her improv group.
As a person with a disability, I can help a non-disabled person relax.
Hobbin rehearsing with her improv group.
We're more likely to connect and get past ableism and stereotypes.
Hobbin's braille typist, Hallie, typing to Hobbin. Text. Hobbin also has assistance from her braille typist so she knows what each person is saying. Arrow pointing to Hallie. Hobbin's improv partner speaks.
I know there's a very large contract you have to sign. I didn't read it.
Hobbin talking to her improv partner.
I'm still thinking about the fact that you didn't read the contract.
Crowd laughs. Text. Hobbin finished Harvard Law in 2013. She is the first and only deafblind graduate from Harvard Law. Photo of Hobbin with her parents on graduation day at Harvard.
My parents had high expectations for me, and that taught me to also have high expectations for myself. I decided to become an attorney when I was in college.
Hobbin walking with Hallie and Riverside Country School staff into auditorium.
I noticed that when I used the Americans with Disabilities Act to remove barriers, it changed the whole culture, and I wanted to continue doing that.
Auditorium filling with students in bleachers.
I can't let fear control my life. I'm going to instead focus on what I can do.
Hobbin talking to audience.
Sign language is a form of innovation. I was told that if I wanted to get a job as an attorney, I needed to go to the best school possible. So I applied to Harvard, even though I thought I probably wouldn't get in. It was worth a shot just to try.
Students in auditorium clapping.
I learned that I got in, and I was thrilled.
Hobbin showing her keyboard to the auditorium.
Now I travel around the world teaching organizations to invest in accessibility.
Hobbin shakes a student's hand. Text. Hobbin is an advocate for accessibility and technological advances.
The majority of apps are not accessible.
Hobbin typing on her keyboard.
We keep asking engineers, developers, design with access in mind.
Hobbin texting her friend Gordon.
Reply. Button.
Because it drives innovation, drives revenue, and benefits all of us in the long run.
Text, quote, don't call me inspirational, end quote. Hobbin skiing with guide.
People with disabilities get called inspirational all the time.
President Obama giving Hobbin a hug in the White House.
My response is, what are you inspired to do? Allow that emotion to drive change. Disability is not the biggest barrier. The biggest barrier is people telling me you can't do something.
Hobbin speaking at the president's address.
Ask people and hold them accountable.
Allow me to share a story.
Panoramic portrait shot of Hobbin.
All my success shows what is possible when we create inclusive communities and give kids with disabilities an opportunity from the start. Inclusion is a choice.
CNBC Make It End Credits.
Okay, well, Hobbin Grandma, she might be blind, she might be deaf, but she's definitely not disabled, and she's not handicapped. Let me read a little bit more about her. She's got a Wikipedia page, born July 29, 1988. The first deaf-blind graduate of Harvard Law School. Early life and education. Grandma was born in Oakland, California in 1988. Her father and mother were both from Eritrea in Africa. Her mother fled Eritrea in 1983 during the Eritrean War of Independence and met her father in California. Hobbin lost her vision and hearing as a result of an unknown progressive condition beginning in early childhood. She retains 1% of her sight. At 15, Grandma or Hobbin traveled to Mali to do volunteer work building schools. Let's see. Hobbin attended Lewis and Clark College, where she successfully, obviously, graduated. Then, as she graduated from Lewis and Clark, magna cum laude, in 2010, she became the first deafblind student to attend and graduate from Harvard Law School, earning a J.D., Juris Doctorate, in 2013. Let's see. She enjoys participating in physical activities, including surfing. And if you go on YouTube, there are videos of her surfing. This is a woman who's blind and deaf. All right, she's got only has 1% of her sight. Now, what they might call that, legally blind? I don't know. But she's surfing. There's a video of her surfing. She rock climbs. She does kayaking. She cycles. And she dances. She does not play into the narrative of ableism, and neither did Harriet Tubman. So in 2020, this is just me, crazy LA, I can't see how I'm not even going to say that word that starts with an A. I don't see where the reparations comes in at. Not in 2020. Isaiah Montgomery, Ben Montgomery, all those people knew slaves. All three of those people were slaves. Heaven Grima, or Grima, now her mother escaped from Eritrea let's read about the Eritrean War of Independence. Because her mother was actually in a war zone. And most of the people that are whining for reparations have never been in a war zone. You know, and this really requires a whole podcast in itself. The Eritrean civil wars, list of massacres. Now, there are a list of massacres that happened in Eritrea, if I'm pronouncing that right. And this is contemporary history. 1967 on up to April 24th, 1990. Where, I don't know, one massacre in the country that her mother came from, 172 people killed. Another one, 60 people killed. Another one, 800-plus people killed. Another one, 170-plus people killed. 1975 to 2014, anywhere from up to 3,000 people killed in the Asmara area of Eritrea. There are quite a few massacres in that country that happened. Her mother escaped from that. So we're talking about her mother, who escaped a war zone, made her way to the United States. If her mother isn't making excuses, if her mother hasn't played into the ableism mindset, if her mother never looked at herself as handicapped, never looked at herself with a disability, never played the victim, and she passed those qualities on to her daughter. That's the same mindset that we need to have in 2020. Anyway, Harriet Tubman, reparations tycoon for today. At least that's my spin on it. Let's see, 314 area code, your mic is open.
Yeah, LA, you are absolutely right. But you know, you got some of these voices out here would say, well, white supremacy let one or two get through. Same old crap. And you know, another thing, I sent you some emails. A lot of stuff they claim that Harriet Tubman said and done, she didn't do, nor did she say. And that just goes to show how people like to go back and grab a hold of someone in history and use them for their own benefit and selfish gains.
Yep, their own agenda.
That's right. To fit in order to make their agenda more palatable and sensational through the use of emotions. She never said that she would have freed more if they only knew they were slaves. Never did she say that. She didn't carry no rifle neither. She didn't have no quilted blanket. All that's a bunch of stuff people made up. And that's really terrible. Because folks don't read
that's true.
They like to go and be entertained. And I be down. They take them entertainment myths and use them as basis for convincible talking points.
Right.
And blacks do it worse than anybody else.
Well,
they always saying, well, they didn't tell us. They didn't teach us. Well, hell, you have a chance to, and you don't either, for those that say that.
That's why I'm putting this stuff out there with a different spin on stuff. Based on, you know, what's documented, you know, because hopefully it'll enlighten some people.
Yeah, it's just like Maxine Waters driving down the street, I guess. See where there's a police stop of a motor vehicles.
You know, I briefly scanned that this morning.
Yeah.
She pulled over here.
And she jumps out and hoops and hollering at somebody that's filming it, talking about she's going to make sure everything goes right. She doesn't have a mask on. And basically what she's doing is interfering with police work and being an elected official. She's not supposed to do that, really. Hell, I know some elected officials that got recalled for doing that stuff. Jimmy Matthews in St. Louis flashing his alderman badge, acting like he's a police officer.
That could have been a photo op with her. I don't know.
Oh, it turned into one.
Yeah, it turned into one.
So she talked to the people that was filming it first and told her what she going to do. Didn't have no mask on. Hey, she could have had a mask on, a breast price thing. But anyway, I wasn't there.
Oh, okay. Well, Bianca, we're going to cut it short by about 25 minutes today. So anyway, people, we'll be back tomorrow with more. Have a good day.